Om Parthaya Pratibodhitam Prakatata Narayanena Swayam Yasena Kratitam Purana Munina Madhye Mahabharatam Advaitamrita Varshinim Bhagavatim Ashtadashadhyayinim Ambatvam Anusantatami Bhagavad-gita Bhagavad-vaishinim. Okay, let's start again with verse 1, chapter 15.
November
21st, chapter 15, verse 1. Huh?
15.
Yeah. Chapter 15, verse 1. Again. Shri Bhagavan Uvacha.
Shri Bhagavan Uvacha.
Urdhvamulamitashakam. Ashwatthampraahuravyayam chandamsi yasya paranani yastam vedasa vedavita urdhvamulam adha shakam Ashwatthaṁ prahuhu avyayam chandamsi yasya paranani yaha tam veda savedavita. So Sri Bhagavan Uvacha, Bhagavan says, urdhvamulam. Urdhva means above. The mula, the root is above, root, that which has its roots above, urdhvamulam. Adha shakam, and its branches below. These are bahuvrahis. What is ashwatthaṁ prahuhu? Those who know the prahuhu, the Vedavits, those who know the Vedas, they say prahuhu, that the ashwatthaṁ tree, ashwatthaṁ is for the ashwatthaṁ tree. The ashwatthaṁ, ashwatthaṁ actually means that which is not here tomorrow. Shwa means tomorrow, that which is not here tomorrow. So it means that which is ever-changing. So those who know say that this ashwatthaṁ tree has its root above and its shakas, its branches below. So urdhvamulam, whose roots, bahuvrahi, for whom the roots, the mula, the roots are above, and the shaka, the branches, the shakam, are adha, are below. That tree, they say, that ashwatthaṁ tree, which is by ashwatthaṁ, that which is not here tomorrow, means it continually changes, it is avyayam, it is imperishable. It is continually changing, but it is not destroyed. Okay, so I'll go into that in a minute. So this tree, which is the ashwatthaṁ tree, which is continually changing, but is imperishable, never destroyed, it has its roots above, its root, some will say its taproot, has its taproot above and below all of its branches. And then it says, chandamsi yasya paranani, its leaves are the Vedas, the chandas is the Vedas, for whom the leaves, the parna's leaves, for who the leaves are the Vedas. So, and it says, whose leaves are the Vedas, yaha, he who knows tam, this ashwatthaṁ tree, he who knows it, yaha tam veda, saha vedavit, he is one who knows the Vedas. The one who knows this one knows the Vedas. Okay. It's another way of saying the one who knows this knows all that is to be known. The Vedas, remember, the Vedas are divided into the whole Vedic scripture. The Rig Veda, we're talking mainly here, Rig Veda, Yajur Veda, Sama Veda. The Vedas are divided into two parts, the Karmakanda and the Jnanakanda. The first part, the Karmakanda, deals with all of the branches. And we'll see in the next verse that which has its roots below. So everything that you can see means this whole manifest creation is the Karmakanda. That's the first part of the Vedas. The Jnanakanda, so karma, means the Karmakanda means part. So it is the part that deals with karma. So karma, the Vedas really, the whole Karmakanda, really, not only we can use the karmas just for rituals, but also for dharma, adharma, punya, and papa. So the whole order of action in reference to Ishvara. So if we say in reference to Ishvara, if we're as the mumukshus who are studying to gain this knowledge, when we say the greatest means for antakarana shuddhi is, we could say, karma yoga. Karma yoga for a mumukshu, somebody who's exposed to knowledge, the greatest means for antakarana shuddhi, purification of mind, is the karma yoga, because it neutralizes raga dvesha. It neutralizes likes and dislikes and puts in the forefront that Ishvara Arpana Buddhi. Ishvara Arpana Buddhi means where I have a commitment, my buddhi, what is important to me, my commitment is toward Ishvara Arpana, a worship of Ishvara, worship of the Lord. How do you worship the Lord? The whole Upanishad are really revealing the nature of the Lord, but how do you worship the Lord? What does that mean, Ishvara Arpana Buddhi? It really means dharma, following dharma, because that is Ishvara's order. So when I'm going against Ishvara's order, when I'm going against dharma, that's the jiva srishti. But the jiva is capable of going against the order. And of course, in going against the order, all you get is some dukkha, that's all. You get some pain. That going against the order is included in the order. But the going against the order of the creation gives you dukkha, makes you suffer, it gives you pain, which pushes you back into the order, right? Because we don't like pain, right? So the universe really teaches us through dukkha, sukha and dukkha. But the problem is when relatively I experience some sukha in the world, I will go after that sukha. I will go after that pleasure. And that pleasure becomes Ishvara for me. This is what the whole problem is. This is when I go after sukha, pleasure, right? I am superimposing the ananda, which is really the self of Ishvara, really the being of Ishvara. I'm superimposing that onto an object. And so then I have a raga. I have a desire for the attainment of that particular object, because I want the ananda. I desire the ananda. With the Ishvara Arpana Buddhi, that Karma Yoga Buddhi, what I am doing is giving up the focus on an object and focusing on Ishvara instead. I'm not going after an object for ananda. I'm going after Ishvara for ananda. And so, if I'm going after Ishvara for ananda, the Lord for ananda, then what would that make my relationship to the world? Say I see the ananda as Ishvara. Then my relationship to the world is going to be one of being in, I would say, if I can use this word, being in compliance with the natural order. The natural order of things is dharma. It's not raga dvesha. Raga dvesha, likes and dislikes, my likes and dislikes, are the natural order of the jiva. That's the jiva srishti. Jiva srishti means it's the jiva's creation. Okay, here's Ishvara srishti, the creation as it is. The jiva srishti is my superimposition onto Ishvara srishti of my own raga dvesha. I like this, I don't like this. I like this situation, I don't like this situation. This will make me happy, this will be sad, make me sad. That's the whole jiva srishti. What a mumukshu gives up is this jiva srishti. We give up the jiva srishti because it doesn't work. That's what makes you, So when you realize that, you become a mumukshu. When you realize that the raga dveshas, your likes and dislikes, the pursuing of the things that you like so that you can be happy, the trying to get rid of the things that you don't like so you can be happy, none of this works. It only gives momentary, some momentary shanti. That doesn't work. So we give that, we slowly, slowly give that up. And we replace it as we start to gain this knowledge. We replace it with that karma yoga buddhi, that Ishvara Arpana buddhi. That karma yoga buddhi really is where I put my raga dveshas aside because I've gained a vairagya. It means I've gained a dispassion toward them. I've gained a dispassion toward them because they don't give me what I'm actually seeking. If you ever have the experience, which you never have, and this is what you realize, if you ever had the experience that the fulfillment of a desire took care of all of the problems, you know, or if you had, even if you could cite an example of somebody who by the fulfillment of any given desire all of a sudden became free, then you might have a role model. You've never had the experience for yourself, and you've never had the experience for anybody else either. All you've noticed in your life is that you get momentary happiness from the fulfillment of desires. And when you fulfill a desire, you have the momentary happiness, then you just go back to normal. Get a momentary and you're just back to normal, so that has never happened. Right? It's an amazing, amazing thing. Even if a great big desire, you fulfill it, you get a momentary happiness. When the desire has been fulfilled, it's gone, and then you're back to square one. You're just back to normal. You can continually experience this, or you can fulfill a desire, have a momentary happiness, and then have an obstruction come and take it away from you, and then you become very sad. So this is the samsara that we all experience. There comes a time when you are mature, you become a mumukshu, you are ready to find another way. You are ready to look at another option. And that's when this karma yoga buddhi becomes meaningful. Because as you become exposed to this knowledge, then what happens? The whole Veda starts to become available to you. The first half of the Vedas is really trying to give you a structure that allows you to live a dharmic life and to fulfill your raga dveshas, to fulfill your likes and dislikes within a dharmic structure. That's the first half of the Vedas, where you have a recognition of Ishvara, you have a recognition of the laws of karma, you have a recognition of punya and papa. All of these things are known to you. There's all kinds of stories, the itihasas, the Mahabharata, the Ramayana, all of these, so many stories, giving you a value system that can allow you to live a relatively peaceful life following Dharma, right? You're still trying to fulfill your raga dveshas, but you're trying to fulfill them within that Vedic understanding of Dharma, within Ishvara's order. That's the first part of the Karmakanda. The second, the first part of the Vedas that we call the Karmakanda. All of the rituals and everything that you need to do to kind of live within Ishvara's creation in a way that's relatively true to Ishvara, to Dharma. The second half of the Vedas, the Jnanakanda, that deals just with self-knowledge, that remains something that the sadhus know. Mm-hmm. The sannyasis know. The jnanis know. The great mahatmas know. They know these are the Upanishads. This is just a regular Indian mentality. They know they're there, the Jnanakanda that deals with self-knowledge, the Upanishads. That sacred teaching is there. We have wise men. We have enlightened beings, you know. We have beings who have self-knowledge, beings, liberated beings. And when I want that, when I'm ready for that, then I can go up to the Himalayas and I can study with one of these wise men who can teach me, or wise women, who can teach me the Upanishads. This knowledge is there when I'm ready for it. I know that. Right? But that Jnanakanda is part of the Vedas. The one who knows the Vedas, he who knows the Vedas, right, is the one who knows both the Jnanakanda and the Karmakanda. Not just half, not just one. You have to know the rules of the tree. This is the tree out here. Everything that we can experience through our sense organs, in our mind, all of our thoughts, all of our moods, all of our emotions, all of the Dharma, all of the laws that regulate all of this, if we understand the Vedas, what I should do, what I shouldn't do, what things I should veer away from in order to maintain a relative shanti, could even teach me, don't put your hand in fire because if you do it will get burned, you know. Don't do these type of actions because they will cause you pain. Don't do these type of actions, they'll cause you a bad next birth. Do these type of actions, follow these type of, live within this type of dharmic structure so that you'll have relative shanti and you can get a better next birth. All of these type of things. This is all the first part of the Vedas, trying to make you understand the order of dharma, the order, Ishwara's order. And then also making you understand that within this order of dharma, there's what we call punya and papa. Punya. Punya is the subtle result of actions which are within Dharma, which are really like the golden rule. If you want to know what's going to give you punya, you know, or positive results to your action, it would be like the golden rule, ahimsa, non-injury. Don't do to others as you wouldn't have done to yourself, and do to others as you would like to have done to you. Non-injury. That non-injury will bless you. That golden rule will bless you. It'll give you a better next birth. It'll give you some shanti in this life. But then with the Vedas, they get much more specific also. You start with the ahimsa, with the non-injury, go to the golden rule, then go to all of the specifics based upon where you were born, whether you're a brahmana, whether you're a kshatriya, all kinds of rules to make you kind of, to educate you around what will give you relative shanti in this world. That's the first part of the Vedas. And so as I learn that, I also, this is again the Karma Yoga Buddhi, I learn all of this, I understand Ishwara in terms of Dharma, in terms of my behavior, and then also I know how to pursue my likes and dislikes within Dharma. Right? This is what we learn, even in every religion in the world. We learn how to pursue our likes and dislikes within Dharma, not against Dharma. You know, I need a certain amount of money in order to buy something that I want. You know, and so I'm willing to work for that money to get this thing that I want. And I'm willing to work for that money in a legitimate way to save it, to buy what I need. Okay, or should I just steal it? Or should I just steal it? Because I want this thing. So I know from my training, from my upbringing, and from my personal experience, that doesn't work to go against Dharma. We learn this on more and more and more subtle levels. Because the going against Dharma hurts me in terms of my shanti. We go on and on and on learning this. But also as we mature, we go on learning not only that, but I have to keep the pursuit of my likes and dislikes within Dharma. I also start to learn that my pursuits of my likes and dislikes really are not capable of giving me what I seek. And as I understand this, on an all-encompassing, no exceptions level, the second part of the Vedas starts becoming interesting to me. Until I understand that the second part of the Vedas, the Upanishads, are nice to know that they're there. Because if I ever need them, you know, when it's time for me, then I can do that. Mm. But Indians have that security. That is there waiting for me. When I can't take it anymore, you know, I can't take it anymore, there's an answer. But they do reach that point, and we all reach that point, where that answer becomes predominant. And I need that, and I need that. And that's why when you think of the Vedas, then that that part of the Vedas, you know, makes the Vedas complete. So there's the tree, and then there's the root of the tree. The tree is the whole samsara. And here they say this whole samsara vriksha. So they say like this, this ashwata tree, this ashwata tree which continually changes every moment. It's not here in the next moment. It's never here tomorrow in the same way that it is today. It goes on changing and changing and changing. But this ashwata tree, this whole manifest creation, the whole thing, right? The entire manifest creation that we perceive, right, Tiz? Yeah, it's all crowded in here. Yeah. The whole manifest creation, you know, the Sashwata tree that we perceive, it's something that has its roots above. It means you don't really know what, or until you know, you don't know. You don't really know what is the ground of its being. What is the taproot? What is, from where does it come? What is its source? What is the mula? What is the root? You can't see it. All you can see with your means of knowledge, even when if you think about whatever you can think about, whatever you can perceive, whatever you can feel, you know, with all of your sense organs, whatever you can see out here, that's the tree. But what is the root of the tree? You can't see the root. The root is above. What they mean by above, it's outside of your range. It's above you. It's outside of your range. It's outside of your scope. So the taproot is not available for your perception. The tree is available for your perception. And this tree, all of the branches, all of them are below, the root is above. And these branches, all of the branches that are there, they all have for their leaves the Vedas. The Vedas are their leaves because the Vedas protect the tree. If you were to cut all of the leaves off the tree, then the tree couldn't live. But the Vedas protect the leaves, as leaves they protect the tree. They protect the tree with dharma, with all of the rituals, with an understanding of really what is the knowledge that allows the tree to survive. You go against dharma, then the tree will die. You know, it won't be able to survive. It'll crumble into adharma. It will always survive on one level. It's avyayam, it's indestructible on one level. While it's here, you can kill it. Yeah. You can make it suffer. You can make the world suffer. You can make all beings suffer. You can destroy the shanti in the world. You can do all of that. But the world itself, the Ashwata tree, is avyayam because it comes into manifestation and it goes into avyakta. It's cyclical. It's like breath. It comes into manifestation. While it's manifest, you can do all kinds of damage to it, the jiva srishti. You can do all kinds of damage. You can hurt other beings. You can hurt the earth itself. You can destroy. You know? But as long as the creation is manifest, you can make a whole mess out of it. But you know what? It's avyayam. It will just go into unmanifest condition and then manifest again and start all over. Go into unmanifest condition, manifest again, and start all over. It's kind of like if you imagine a continuous dream. The dream comes into manifestation, nice and fresh. Just imagine the dream as being, they use this example, and you can think of the universe as a whole dream that comes into manifestation. It's like 4 o'clock in the morning for Brahmaji. Everything is fresh, you know, fresh and awake and clean. The universe comes into manifestation. And then it starts getting tired. You know, it goes through the first part of the day and the second part of the day, and then we get, you know, into the night, and by that time, you know, it's wearing out. It's dark outside. It's all Kali Yuga. It's dark outside, and all the ghosts and goblins are starting to take over. And then it goes into unmanifestation. It comes into manifestation, unmanifestation, manifestation, unmanifestation. While it's there, we can do all kinds of damage. The Vedas, and say religion, the Vedas, you know, protect the tree by giving all of the dharmis, all of the beings, some knowledge about right and wrong, Punya and Papa, what works, what doesn't work, what are the rituals, how to treat the earth, how to treat the gods, how to be one, how to be in relationship to Ishwara. All of these things are in the first part of the Vedas. But then there's also room for, in the second part of the Vedas, how to know, you know, how to engage here properly. Those leaves protect. And then the second part of the Vedas is really the Jnanakanda, is for those who are now kind of wanting to be released from the tree and go back to the root. How can I go back to the root? How is that possible? So it says, really, and as we'll see, really in order to go back to the root, to know the truth, to know the root, you really have to know both parts of the Vedas. You have to know the taproot, the one that has the roots above, and you also have to understand the branches below. What is the root? What are the branches? The Vedas protect the branches. And so the leaves protect the branches. So he who knows that person is a Vedavid. You know? He knows the whole. Then he knows the whole. He knows really, you know. Because if you think about it just like this, to know the whole even as yourself, as you'll see, yourself as part of this tree, to know the whole, you have to know who you are, you know, what is your core, what is your root, but from where do you come, what is your source, from where do you come, you know, and what is the relationship of that source to the tree. You have to know the source, you have to know the root, you have to know the tree. Reference to this, what is the tree? Just in reference to your body. This body is a tree, right? Your sense organs are part of the tree. Your thoughts are part of the tree. Your moods and your emotions are part of the tree. Even the changing eye thought are part of the tree. Your memories are part of the tree. Anything that comes and goes, anything that's the ashwata, anything that comes and goes, all of that is part of the tree. And what is the root of that tree? It's you, the one who is ever present to the tree, right? The tree comes from you, sustained by you, goes back into you. Who is that you? Who is that you that is the taproot of the tree? So, he goes on with this next verse, verse 2, to give more about the tree. So let's do this one. A little bit more on it. Adastrodvam prasvatastasyashakaha. Adastrodvam prasvatastasyashakaha. Gunat pravritta vishayat pravalaha. Gunat pravritta vishayat pravalaha. Adascha mulan yanisantatani. Adascha mulan yanisantatani. Karmanubandhini manushyaloke. Karmanubandhini manushyaloke. Adhacha urdvam. Prasvataha tasya shakaha guna pravriddhaha vishaya pravalaha adhacha mulani anusantatani karma anubandhini manushya loke. So he says, going on, he says, these branches, remember from the last one, says the branches are below Adashaka. Okay. Now he says, these branches which are coming down below, these branches go down and they go up. Adaha means they come down, the branches come down like this, and the other branches go up like this. Okay. But all of them are below, but of the ones that are below, some come down, some go up. The branches are the jivas. The branches that go up, the shakas that go up, those are all the devatas. You know, all of the Indra and Varuna and all of the higher beings, all of the devatas. Those branches are all going up. They're going up into the higher planes. and more on them. They're more subtle. They're the devatas that we can pray to, Ganesha, all of them. They're all the branches that are going up. The branches that are going down are all the minutiae, the human beings, the animals, you know, the ones that are down here in this worldly loka. So in the ones, the beings that are in the heaven worlds, all of the heaven worlds going up, those are all those devatas. Just imagine those branches, they're all going up in this way, and then all of these branches coming down, those are all of us and our animals. Okay. So adha means down, urdhvam means up, prasrita tasisha kaha. So that tasya means avyat, of the ashwata tree, the shakas, those branches, they spread all over. Prasrataha means they go all over. They're spreading all over upward and spreading all over downward. And what nourishes or what allows for those branches to be, guna pravridaha. They're growing and changing and going through whatever they go through, taking all of the different namarupas, all of the different names and forms, because of the three gunas, the whole maya. This tree is really the whole maya upadi, right? The maya itself is made of sattva, rajas, and tamas. So all the combinations of sattva, rajas, and tamas go into making these jivas. So all jivas means all of these living beings. It's all of the gunas. So in this chapter 14, if you recall, all of the different states of mind that you have, all of the different pursuits that you have, all sattva, rajas, and tamas. Sometimes your mind is very sattva. It's very focused on knowledge. It has a lot of shanti and peace. Sometimes your mind is very rajasic, and then it becomes aggressive, and it becomes very pursuing over your, I want this, and I want that, and I want this, and I want that. It has a lot of aggressive and assertive energy. That's rajas. Sometimes it is just slothful and tired. It doesn't really want to do anything. It would rather just sit, lie around, and watch TV. That's enough. That's tamas. So this play of the gunas is what really feeds these shakas, these branches. And in fact, on another level, the whole creation, the whole tree is nothing but the play of the gunas. But if you look at it in terms of the shakas, and in terms of the branches, in terms of all of these devatas and all of the beings, they are different manifestations of sattva, rajas, and tamas. So the devas have a lot of sattva. The human beings are a combination. The animals are usually considered more tamasic, you know. But different types of the gunas are feeding all of these beings in different ways. And so then, that being so, that feeding all of these branches are the three gunas. And then these branches, and remember each branch is really a minutia, it's a jiva. At the tips of these branches are these buds. Little buds. They're called pravalas. These pravalas, these little buds, are the vishayas, are the sense objects. So every branch, every jiva, has these sense objects that are attached to it. And what these sense objects do is give every jiva this pravritti and nivritti, these sense objects that are there, that are right in your vicinity, they're just right around you, they're right on you. They're part of you. And they're saying, I want this. They cause the jiva to say, I want this, and I want this, and I want this, and I don't want this, and I don't want this, and I don't want this. They're responsible, really, for your pursuits. They're responsible for your karma. And so your relationship to these vishayas will really cause the accruing of punya and papa, which will be responsible for your next birth. Okay? So it's your relationship to these little nodules, these little buds that each shaka, that each branch has, that will cause your next birth through the punya, through punya and papa. So now what it says is these nodules, these vishayas, which cause your pursuit, actually are what are going to keep you here. So what he says then, he says, for this tree now, which has its taproot, Brahman, which has its taproot above, and now it has all of these branches that have all of these nodules on the end, all of these branches have roots. They're rooted. They have roots coming down. That's why they use this Ashwata tree, this people tree. The people tree in India, the Ashwata tree, it's a very unusual tree. It, as it spreads out, it can be, these people trees can be huge. They can go for miles, actually. The roots come off the shakas. They come off the branches. And they root themselves into the earth. Right? So the roots come from above, off of the branches, and they ground themselves into the earth. And so then they hold the branches to the earth. It's called a people tree. So here he's using this Ashwata tree because it has the roots coming down. So all of these branches, for the devatas also and for the manushas, these roots are coming down, rooting themselves into the earth. And it is, so they say, so what are these roots that are coming down? And anusantatani means they go everywhere. These roots that are coming down, they spread everywhere because they're thinking the people tree. They're all pervasive, these roots. And what are the roots? These roots are karma anubandhani. These roots are the karmas that bind you. Right? So these roots that come down are the karmas that bind you. What really causes the karmas are the little buds, the little vishyas that are dangling there in front of you. So these little vishyas are, vishyas means sense objects, they're dangling there in front of you. Like, I need this to be happy, I need this to be happy, I don't want this thing to be happy. And then that causes karma. Karma means your pursuit of that given object. That's the karma, right? Now how do you pursue how do you pursue it? This is where all the raga dveshas, your likes and dislikes, come in. Now, are those pursuits, because of your raga dvesha, because of your likes and dislikes, do those pursuits, are they contained within dharma or not? If they're contained within dharma, you're safe. You know, you'll still be disappointed. Because no accomplishment gives anything except a momentary pleasure. It's not like the accomplishment will you be able to say, oh, finally I've made it. Now I've done everything that is to be done. I'm a full, whole, complete person. It never happens. You make these wonderful accomplishments and you're happy that you have the accomplishment, but you didn't get this thing that you're trying to achieve. That doesn't happen. That's disappointing. But you still have the relative shanti because you're within dharma. You haven't done anything really to cause dukkha to yourself or to others if your pursuit is within dharma. And so you still have a relative shanti. You're still qualified to get better birth. You know, you're not out of balance in terms of if you look at your life as a scale. See, at the time of your death, I'm just making this up, but it's more or less true. Yeah. But I'm making the image up. I think Swamiji's used it, actually. I kind of remember. See, at the time of your death, you know, you've done so many karmas this particular life. And so here's the scale. And this is the karma that has been contained within dharma. You know, so it's either neutral or punya. Punya means it gives you relative happiness here and it will accrue to a better next birth. Punya is subtle, really. Okay? And then here on this side, you know, you've got the papa, the karmas that were not contained by dharma at all. They were contained by raga and dvesha. Right? That's your choice. We're all going to have desires until you have knowledge and the desires just become mithya. Your desires are either contained within dharma, or they're not. They're contained within dharma. They're basically relatively neutral. They're not really harmful. If they're contained within a dharma, then they cause pain for you and others. So here's the scale. What's your balance? Here's punya, here's papa. So is it like this? Then you're going to go down. Seven lokas up, seven lokas down. Okay? Temporarily. Okay, so that's a lot of papa karma. Those karmas are going to have to be exhausted. And the trajectory of you as a jiva, you know, because you're taking birth after birth after birth, the trajectory is like this. Right? This is the trajectory, because that's kind of been the essential focus, you know, or direction of your life. Now say it's like this instead of this way, you know, the scale is like this. Punya, then seven levels up. Then you'll be exhausting karmas on these other lokas. And but either case, whether it's like this or like this, you end up back here in this Manushya loka. Everything ends up back here in this particular loka. So you have some bad vipapa karmas, and so you have some negative experiences in between. You've got some punya karmas, you have some positive experiences in between. Eventually you take a birth here again, using 50-50, and you go through this whole thing over and over and over again. It just goes on and on and on like that, you know, where you're experiencing lifetime after lifetime after lifetime in a variety of combinations of punya and papa based upon your relationship to the vishyas, the little nodules, you know, that were on the tip of your branch. So those nodules keep the karmas going, and those karmas are what really root you here. Remember, here what they're using as karma is this template. I need this to be happy. That's karma. I need this to be happy. I want this so that I can be happy. Positive or negative? I want this so that I can be happy. I don't want this so that I can be happy. All right, this doesn't matter how you say it. I want this to be happy. I don't want this to be happy. And so as long as I am bound to the little nodules, right? Those are forming those karmas that drive me to pursue. Those karmas are what keep me here. Okay? So that being in this Manushya loka, in this Manushya means human. In this loka, in this human world, it is these karmas, the pursuit of these little nodules, these vishyas, these sense objects, that really bind me here. So that being so, let's just read this next verse so that I can keep the thread, and then we'll do it next week. Narupamasye hetato palabhyate. Narupamasye hetato palabhyate. Nanto nacha dira nicha sampratishta. Nanto nacha dira nicha sampratishta. Ashwatthamenam suvirudhamulam. Ashwatthamenam suvirudhamulam. Asangashastrena dhritena chitva. Asangashastrena dhritena chitva. Narupam asya iha tata upalabhyate. Na antaha nacha adihi. Nacha sampratishta. Ashwattham enam suvirudha mulam asanga shastrena dridena chitva. He says, of this tree that we're experiencing, narupam, the nature of it, the rupa of it, of this tree here, isn't known. As it really is, this tree that we're experiencing, we don't really understand it. We don't really know what it is. It is it has no end. Na adihi, it has no beginning. And na pratishta, sam pratishta, what we experience here, right? What it is exactly we experience while it's here, that we don't know. We can't know. It's not really here either. Right? It has no end, it has no beginning, and what we experience here is not really here either. Ashwattam, this ashwatta tree, ashwattam enam, which is suvirudhamulam. This ashwatta tree, which has very deep roots, it is so firmly rooted, as per the previous verse. It's so strongly rooted. It is this ashwatta tree, he says, asanga shastrena dridena chitva. It's this tree that first of all has to be cut through, he says, through the sword, through the shastra of asanga, non-attachment. The asanga shastra through the sword of non-attachment, which is dridha, which is very firm, through the unwavering sword of non-attachment, vairagya, this tree, which is so firmly rooted, but has so many firm roots in this karma, and all of these buds, all of the raga, dvesha, all of the pursuits of my likes and dislikes. The only way for me to become released from this tree is to cut it down through asanga, through non-attachment. But having cut it down through non-attachment, that's not enough. I've cut the tree down and now I just don't have a tree. That's not enough. Then I just have nothing. I have no attachment to any of this at all, but I also have no knowledge. So the non-attachment has to be accompanied, has to be fulfilled, really, by knowledge of the taproot, by knowledge of the root. Then this asanga, the vairagya that you start gaining, well, this tree is not really working for me very well. You know, all of these karmas, all of these things, really they're not able to give me the ananda, the wholeness that I seek. I start gaining that very deep vairagya. But as I gain that vairagya, then from that I have to go further. So this verse 3 and 4 kind of work together. So I'll go into that next week in some depth. Just wanted to make that connection there. Then we'll do verse 3 next week. Okay? So just a moment.
Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vashishyate. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. Hari Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha. Hari Om.
Tree is this tree the tree of knowledge or the tree of samsara?
It's both. Well, it's the tree of samsara, but the root is Brahman. The tree of samsara, the Ishvata tree, has for its root Brahman. And so knowledge really is knowledge of the whole. Right? We usually only have knowledge of the tree. Mm-hmm. We don't have knowledge of the root. If you don't have knowledge of the root, then you're missing what is really the very being of the tree. And so you have to get knowledge of the root. But for your mind to be available for knowledge of the root, you have to kind of be able to pull it back from all of the buds and all of the karmas that you're involved in, all of the raga, dvesha, all of the likes and dislikes that you're involved in, you know, to gain really the root from the... You're trying to gain the root, the ananda, or the truth of the whole thing by running after your raga dvesha's. And so that's why this asanga shastra, the sword of non-attachment of asanga, has to come into play. And the only way that can come into play is if there's some viveka starts to take place. The viveka is that discrimination is that all of these pleasures are time-bound, all of them. All of my gains, every single one of them is time-bound. It can't give me the wholeness that I'm seeking. I think everybody would like to say, I am a whole, complete person. And some things go well and some things don't go well. I fulfill some desires, I don't fulfill other desires. I have positive situations and negative situations, but I'm fine. I am a whole, complete person, no matter what is going on here. It's not like I want the world to become kind of a Pollyanna thing where all of a sudden everybody just comes very nice to me and is just feeding me pablum all the time, you know, so that I'm just well taken care of by the world. I don't think people expect that. You know, that's just not, there's no experience to validate that. But, I mean, it just doesn't make sense to ask the world, let me become enlightened, which means let the whole world become nice to me. It's not going to happen. But I would like to be whole and complete in spite of the world. The world, when it's in me, pleasing me, is fine. And when the world is difficult, that's also fine. Because my wholeness isn't dependent on that, you know. And freedom. That's what when we say I'm free. I'm free because my wholeness is not dependent upon that which is ashwata. Ashwata means continually changing. If your wholeness is dependent on something that's continually changing, in the Gita, one beautiful thing about the Gita, these things that continually change, the Gita really systematically goes through all of the things that continually change that might matter for you. Like in terms of whether a person respects you or doesn't respect. We just went through these verses in chapter 14. Sometimes a person loves you, they respect you, they think you're wonderful, you know, and it's all nice and you can feel fine, and then they think you're awful. That mana, you know, the censure, ninda, praise, stuti and ninda. They're praising you, you're so great, and then ninda, you're so awful, you're so awful, you're so awful. You're so great, you're so great. You're awful, you're awful. The Gita goes through all of these things that have the capacity to hurt you. You know, even on these emotional levels. And even when you go through this Amani, Torma, Dambi, Torma, Himsa, Kshanti, Arjavanam, all of these things that you memorize, sannyasis memorize this from chapter 13 of the Gita. You know, the first two are Amani, Torma, and Dambi, Torma. Amani, Torma means mana, and it's coming again. And this next verse, this mana, you know, where you have certain things that you do well. Say you're successful and you have a lot of money, or you have a PhD and you're respected by so many of your peers and all this type of thing. Yeah. But for you, if you have this mana, it is necessary for you to really tell everybody that you do have a lot of money. Mm-hmm. Because you want them to respect you, and you think that if you tell them that you have this wonderful thing, money, a lot of it, then they will look at you and say, wow, you are such a great person, you're really amazing, because you have a lot of money, this really makes you something. Or you think, maybe if I have a few PhDs, you know, and then you can say, you know, I have a PhD in this, and I have a PhD in this, and I've written a few books, you know. And then you're saying, why are you saying it? I mean, really, why are you saying it? Just so somebody will say, oh, that's really great, that's amazing. You have a PhD and you've written some books. You're really neat. You're a really neat person. That's what it is, it's weakness, you know?
Yeah, because it won't do it. It won't fill you up.
No, it won't fill you up. And it means that you need that. You need to extol or name drop, name dropping, Oh, I met, you know. I was, you know, I was over at Obama's the other day, and I saw Michelle. Kids are doing great. But it's because, but why, you know? The thing is, maybe you were over at his house the other day, or whatever. It's all true. The thing is, these things are true. But you need to throw them out there because you think it'll make people love you so that you will feel loved. That's the whole thing. So that you will feel loved because you don't feel loved. So this will help you feel loved. That's the first one. That's of the list. That is the first one. The second one, and it comes all the way through, not just there. The second one is adambitum. Adambitum is like, okay, this is how Swamiji tells it. There's a really fancy party. A lot of important people are going to be there, you know. And they all have a lot of money. And they'll all be dropping names like anything, you know. And you have no money, you know, to speak of. And you don't really have the proper attire, right? And you certainly don't have a car that's going to fit in with their cars. And so you just go out and rent a car and borrow some really nice clothes. Right? And then go to the party and try to be a person like them. Right? You want to be a person like them. You're not a person like them, but you're pretending to be a person like them. Because maybe if they think of you as that, somebody who has a lot of money, a good car, and, you know, nice clothes, and maybe you borrowed some jewelry or whatever, you know, then maybe you get to experience being treated in a way that would make you happy, you know. But actually, you don't have any of those things, you know. You don't have any of them at all. Swamiji has a whole scenario that he'll tell. It takes about 15 minutes. Really, really cute, but it's very sad, you know. And I suppose we all, that's an extreme example, but you can all always find some manitwam or dambitwam in yourself, just subtle little things, you know, because you need something. There's some insecurity there. You need something, so you have to build yourself up in some way or another. And the way you build yourself up for others could be something you're bragging about, something true. Putting something out there that's true, or you're putting something out there that's not true, but you think that if they thought that was true, then they would give you the type of love and affection that you need to feel loved inside. You see what I mean? These are they're big things. They're just samsara. It's not even putting it down. It's samsara. This is samsara. This is what happens when we don't have, that the mind has not yet found the source of that being loved. There's a source of being loved. That is the Atma. When your mind is with your own being and it feels loved and feels secure, then you don't need to do things to make yourself feel loved and secure, because you feel loved and secure. You see what I mean? But otherwise, there's all kinds of things that we do. So manitwam, adambitwam, ahimsa. Imsa is causing pain to others. The only reason we cause pain to others is because something's hurting us inside. That's why this value of value, Swamiji's book, is so good. You just take one value at a time and understand really the dynamics of it. What causes all of that to take place? And what's really going on? And then you can do something about it, but you can't do something about it without knowing yourself. You can't just cut down these roots and get rid of everything. That doesn't help either. Without the discovery of the solution. The discovery, the solution is really the ananda, the love that is your own nature, that doesn't come and go. And with that armed with that, that really, that knowledge really allows for this asanga shastra. In the end, vairagya, this asanga, this non-attachment, in the beginning it's just sour grapes non-attachment. For any mumukshu, the non-attachment is, this isn't helping, this doesn't help, it's all negative in a sense.
Mm.
But for when you gain knowledge, it's positive. The non-attachment is because I don't need this to be full because I am full. The negative, when you come to knowledge, when you come for knowledge, it's, you know, this doesn't help me. In the end, this is not giving me what I need, and therefore I've realized that it's not giving me, not only that it's not giving me what I need, that it's impossible. It cannot give me what I need. And so you lose that raga dvesha for it. You know, you lose it because it can't, you know, it can't give it to you. So that's the sour grapes vairagya. This doesn't work, I don't want it. But that converts into, it's not that I don't want it, it's that I don't need it. I can enjoy it, I can be with it, but when it's there, it's fine, and when it's not there, it's fine. That's the freedom. But the only reason I can say that is if I'm whole, if I feel the wholeness of myself, if I've recognized it. And that's the taproot.
Mm.
I have to know both. So you need both the jnanakanda, the karmakanda, for dharma, for Ishvara, for those trees that protect you, the leaves that protect you while you're living here in the midst of all of this samsara, you know, the dharma that protects you, those are the leaves of dharma that protect you while you're here, relatively. But then you need the jnanakanda in order to really cut down that tree of samsara so that it's not relevant anymore, so that you know the source of it, so that you know the source. The source is really the satyam mitya, as we'll see as these verses unfold. The source is the satyam, what is actually here. The tree is mitya. You need to know the satyam, but you can't know the satyam, you know, until you can withdraw your mind a little bit from the mitya. Mitya is the tree that's continually changing.
It's kind of interesting if this image of the upside down tree is upside down.
Yeah, yeah, you know, that's also true. It's upside down.
That are thinking.
Yeah.
Upside down. Although it's a little bit difficult, I think, the tree image of, you know, I mean, because we think contemporarily of cutting down a tree. You know?
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. You know what? We don't want to cut down our trees. We want to save our trees. This is a special type of tree. Yeah. And a special type of sword. The sword of vairagya. It's interesting to really study these and contemplate on these verses and visualize them. Because this chapter 15, again, it's one that we chant all of the time. Just traditionally chanted, as I've said, you know, before the lunch, we'll chant it. But also just that this is such an important chapter because the whole Ishvara is in this chapter. The whole Ishvara, the whole knowledge, what it means to gain knowledge, what it's like, what is the kind of disposition of somebody who has knowledge, all of the whole thing is in these some 15 verses or so. It's a small chapter. It's very complete, and it's a vision. It's almost like an upasana. You can just, if you know what it means when you're chanting it, you can just kind of see the whole thing. And so it's a metaphor. You know?
So it has both. It has the knowledge of Brahman, and it also has the understanding of Ishvara.
That's right, because actually all there is Ishvara. Once you say Ishvara, and if you know what you mean, then there's satyam mitya, because Ishvara is Brahman. Brahman with Maya. Maya is the Swamiji's incidental attribute, right, of Brahman. It means there's really nothing here but Brahman. Maya has no separate being. But say you're lost in the Maya, you totally miss kind of the Urdhvamulam, you know, the root that's above. You're not looking at that. You're looking down here. You're all involved here. You're not looking at the source of the whole thing. But once you know the source of the whole thing, then this tree just becomes mithya. Mithya means it has no existence apart from the root. And the root is the wholeness that you seek. Brahman is the wholeness that you seek. But our minds are so, so totally conditioned to engage out here in terms of raga dvesha, our likes and dislikes. Lifetimes. The whole jiva upadi is external. All of your sense organs, external. Our organs of action, our hands and our feet, and our voice. Everything is meant to engage in this. And so now we continue, you gain knowledge, you continue engaging in this, all the while the mind feeding on its satisfaction coming from Brahman, coming from the self, instead of from the self projected onto the tree. See, all satisfaction really only comes from the self anyway, but it's projected onto the tree. Otherwise, just think of anything that you've ever sought. I need this to be happy, I need this to be happy. You get the thing, and then you end up with the thing, but not the happiness that you've projected onto it. It's all total projection. Everything is. Otherwise, you get the thing, and then you're happy. That's it. As long as you can hang on to that thing. Then what happens, you get that thing, the happiness falls off, and now you're stuck with the thing. It has nothing to do. There's no happiness or anything there. It's just the thing, whatever it is. It's not bad or good. It just has nothing to do with anything in terms of ananda. Zero. It's uncanny. Dukkha, suffering, is the same way. Some object can be such a source of suffering for you. Cause you so much hatred and anger and angst and all of this. That's all equally projection. Otherwise, that object or that person or whatever it is, their very being, is exuding pain. But it's not exuding pain to Joe Blow over here, only to you. Yeah. And then later on, it's not exuding pain to you either. This is all just delusion. Moha, if we call it moha.
And is that the same for the asuras, the ones that are always
doing? It's the same for the whole universe.
Doing our dharma.
Yeah, they're also Brahman. Same thing. But the asuras are not being protected very well by the trees, by the leaves. Dharma protects you by giving you relative shanti and giving you relative positive situation in terms of punya and papa. Immediately, it protects immediately by giving you shanti. In the long term, in terms of birth after birth after birth, it protects you in giving you relatively positive births as opposed to births that have a lot of suffering.
Well, you said that you mentioned the word delusion a lot. And it's a projection, right?
The raga dvesha's are projection, caused by projection of your own ananda on something else.
Right. But it happens so quick that what will be how would you know?
You know when it drops off.
I don't understand what you mean by that. Sorry.
Well, okay. Say for instance, you have a very. It's happening so quick because you haven't really you haven't really had time to recognize these patterns, or your mind's not used to really abiding with yourself. And so it's just automatically you're projecting positively or negatively onto it, to an object. So it happens like that. Okay, mm-hmm. But there's two things that are going to happen. Say you have been kind of exposed to this knowledge and you recognize that at some point what has happened, and then you can pull your mind back. Or say it's happened with such intensity, it's all become so embodied that there's not a thing you can do about it until it kind of wears off. And then you can analyze it. A lot. What we can do is when we're caught in a situation, when the situation changes, which it will, it'll drop off at some point, this intensity, positive or negative intensity, will drop off. Then you become available to look at what's happened in an objective way. But in the middle of it, you're often not available. One thing you can say is, well, I'm not available right now because I'm totally drowning in this situation. As you gain knowledge, at least, that's a little step, right? You can say, I'm totally overcome by the situation. But sometimes you can't even say that. Sometimes for you, the situation is so real. It's so real that you don't have anybody inside to say, this isn't real. You don't even have anybody inside to say, this seems absolutely real, but it may not be. That's a big step. When you have these big projections that take place, projections seem so real. If you can even say, this is so real, I'm positive it's true, I have no doubt, but it may not be. That's a big thing to be able to say that, but it may not be. Because that's how real a projection can be, especially when it has a lot, you know. And then you have to wait and see.
You have to do what?
Wait and see. But you hold that little doubt. That's when you're still being overwhelmed by, you know, unconscious contents that are that are taking you for a ride. Once you start having experiences enough with your projections and the withdrawal of your projections, then you can start to have that little tiny sliver that says, this seems so true and I'm positive of it, but you know what, it may not be. It may not be true. That's very mature to be able to say that, because a projection is so real when it's happening.
And so most of these projections come from the unconscious. I mean, yeah. You don't really deliberate.
No, they're from the unconscious. They're definitely from the unconscious, yeah. Mm. That's what a projection is. And the more you start dealing with the material that's actually inside, those projections lose their strength, but you have to go into the actual source of the projection. Say you're projecting a negative father, or projecting a negative mother, or whatever it is. You believe the projection, because this is the thing. The feelings are more real than our thoughts, right? Feelings are more real. They're more consuming. So you've got this consuming feeling and this little thought up here. There's no comparison between a feeling and a thought. And so now this huge feeling has been triggered, and that feeling lasts longer. It's embodied in the whole system, you know, lasts longer than the thoughts that are actually now taking place within the feeling. So say here you have this big feeling of hurt or whatever the heck it is, whatever it is, and now here's this big feeling, whatever it is, and the thoughts that you have are not displacing the feeling. So here is the feeling, and this little thought comes in and says, okay, this feeling is absolutely real, but it may not be true. The feeling is true because the feeling is happening. But why you're having the feeling, what you're the the reason that you're giving for the feeling may not be true at all. But to be able to say that in spite of the feeling being there requires a lot of viveka and a lot of experience, a lot of understanding. It's easy to tell somebody else that. That's right. You're the therapist or something, you know. Or the friend, you can always tell that person because you can see. But they're totally... And so that for that person who's totally involved to be able to say, yeah, it may not be real, even though I know it is, because it may not be real, even though I'm positive it is.
Until it's your turn.
Huh?
Until it's your turn, as a therapist.
Yeah.
So you don't really have too much control over the unconscious or the negative.
Once you learn how to be with the unconscious, you really do start having some relation. Once you start learning how to have a relationship with it, you really do have some control over it. You really can help. Like say you're overwhelmed by some feeling, whatever it is, you can learn how to come into relationship with it and talk to that feeling and say, what is really going on? What is really hurting you? And then let the feeling talk to you. The feeling is a feeling, and it has its own source, which is coming from the unconscious. The feeling knows where it's coming from, if you can talk to it. But usually, we're so convinced that feeling has come from what so-and-so has done, that we don't realize that the feeling is inside of me, and that it has its own source. So you gain the skill. This is part of... You know, when we say the karma yoga part one is that Ishvara Arpana Buddhi, where I really see everything is Ishvara, everything is really a worship of Ishvara in terms of my following Dharma, and that's my relationship to Bhagavan. The other is Kaushalam. Kaushalam is a skill. It means I know how to handle these situations. So Kaushalam means just knowing how to be in the world, know how to be with others, just externally, how to be with others, and internally, how to be with yourself, how to be with your emotions, how to be with your hurts, how to talk to your unconscious, how to talk to your feelings. We don't think about that. You have a feeling and they did that. Right? But actually, what is so helpful is to say, to have the feeling and then to acknowledge, I do have this really strong feeling, and to go to the feeling and say, what is really bothering you? And let the feeling tell you what's bothering, what's really going on. The feeling will tell you if you sincerely go and ask. But sometimes the defense system is so much that the buddhi, because of the defense system, it doesn't want to ask the feeling. It only wants to blame the other person. It doesn't really want to know. But that goes away or after time, because it's so helpful to come into relationship with the feeling. That's why we do all this inner child stuff.
Is this all part of a sangha?
Well, at this level, it's really just being able to come into relationship with these feelings so that they're not totally overwhelming you. In the end, you can say, vairagya is knowledge. Because vairagya allows you to come into objective relationship with everything. But what is that vairagya that allows you to have objective relationship with everything is knowledge. So in fact, Shankara has this beautiful text that ends with that vairagya equals jnanam. Knowledge is vairagya, vairagya is knowledge. You can't really have vairagya without knowledge. The vairagya, mature knowledge is vairagya. and you can find, look, just watch for your own life. As your knowledge becomes mature, your vairagya becomes mature.
Mm-hmm.
It, because what is the knowledge really is that I am the ananda that I seek. I am the wholeness that I seek. I am the self of all beings. And there is no wholeness outside of my being. So my mind, enjoying my being, appreciates Ishwara. The jiva kind of disappears with knowledge. And the jiva here is mithya. But what ends up is that my mind enjoys the self and appreciates the world as Ishwara. Because when the jiva's head rises its head, it's, I want this so I can be happy. I want this so I can be happy. That's the jiva.
Mm-hmm.
So for a jnani, say that jiva's head is rising, and you just got to pull it back, and it's okay.
So these two verses, the 3 and 4, it's kind of an artificial distinction, in a sense, because they're really, the asanga and knowledge of the root occur together. Kind of
yes, that's right. But yeah. at the beginning, a person gains some vairagya. That's why I was saying that kind of sour grapes vairagya, where the vairagya in the recognition that these things cannot give me what I'm seeking, but you don't know what you're seeking yet. So that vairagya is what allows you to start looking for the root for Brahman. But it hasn't fulfilled itself. It's on just on a negative level. These things are not going to solve the problem. And so I'm not asking them to solve the problem anymore because I'm absolutely clear that they can't. But now I'm seeking for what actually can solve this problem, that give me the wholeness that I seek.
And then you get a little glimpse of it, the reeds part, and you get a little bit more of vairagya from that, and that allows you to see even more.
Yeah. And the more you see, the more every time you see, there's a little bit more vairagya, I'd say like that, because there's a little bit more knowledge. A little bit more knowledge, a little bit more vairagya.
Because
vairagya is not like this, you know, it's not this.
Fancy spider, kind of,
yeah.
They build on each other.
They do. They do build on each other. There's definitely an effect to knowledge, you know? The effect is the removal of the ignorance and its effects. Knowledge removes ignorance and whatever the effects of ignorance are. You know, like say, knowledge of the rope removes the ignorance of the snake and all of the fear the snake caused. And all of the projections the snake caused. All of that is removed. Not only the ignorance of the snake is removed by knowledge of the rope, but all of the byproducts of that ignorance are removed. Even in Vyavahara, even in our daily life, it's like that.
How so?
No, like rope snake. When you've mistaken something, right?
Oh.
And then when you solve that, correct that mistake, all of the reverberations of that mistake are also gone. And so. Are we done yet?
Did the tree very well.
Well, it was a little better than last week. Last week we had trouble getting off the ground with the tree. This is better.